All right, and welcome to another episode of Deep Green Philly. My name is Ron, and I want to thank you for joining me today. So earlier I spoke with Lier Keith and Eric McBay. They both are very much involved with the Deep Green Resistance Movement here in the United States and Canada. They co-wrote the recent book Deep Green Resistance with Derek Jensen, and that book will be available in a few weeks. They also speak very often at workshops and on panels all around the Northern Hemisphere. And I'm very glad that they were able to take the time to speak with me today. It was a, I think, really, really interesting discussion. They don't pull punches. They just tell it like it is. And yet they do give a sense of hope because there is something that we can do to fight back against the destruction that is going on all around us. But before we can fight back, we have to understand the problem. And I think that's what we spent some time doing today, talking about the problem and talking about the solutions to the problem, which essentially is resistance to it. I think before I play the interview, I will give a little bit of an introduction for my two guests. So Eric McBay is an organic dairy farmer living in Canada. He's also trained as a paramedic. He is also very much deeply involved with activism, of course. He's a writer who co-authored a book with Derek Jensen entitled What We Leave Behind, and he also wrote a book called Peak Oil Survival, Preparation for Life After the Grid Crash. And Lier Keith is a longtime activist, the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Conditions of War, and Skylar Gabriel, and she is also an organic farmer. So in this interview, Lier does spend a little bit of time responding to some critiques of her book, The Vegetarian Myth, and that is in part two of the interview. So here is part one, and I hope you enjoy. So I want to start by, actually, this might seem a little bit strange, but I want to start by reading something from a Wikipedia article on the Stockholm Syndrome. Now, you're both familiar with this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so just in case people aren't familiar with the Stockholm Syndrome, it says here on the Wikipedia page that in psychology, Stockholm Syndrome is a term used to describe a paradoxical psychological phenomenon wherein hostages express empathy and have positive feelings towards their captors. So these feelings are generally considered irrational in light of the danger or risk endured by the victims, who essentially mistake a lack of abuse from their captors as an act of kindness. And this term Stockholm Syndrome originated after the, I'm going to butcher this, but it says Norrmalmstorg robbery of the credit bank in Stockholm.
Yeah.
And, and it says a little bit further down that the Stockholm Syndrome is a shift that occurs in captives when they are threatened gravely but are shown acts of kindness by their captors. So these captives who exhibit the syndrome tend to sympathize with and think highly of their captors. And when they're subjected to prolonged captivity, these captives can develop a strong bond with their kidnappers, and in some cases, including a sexual interest. And I've known about this this syndrome for about 5 or 10 years, but I originally was thinking about it in terms of the African-American experience here in the United States. But as I've been thinking more and more about industrial civilization, I've been connecting the Stockholm Syndrome to what maybe we're all experiencing as victims of this system. And I was wondering if you both could speak a little bit about this in connection with this idea that there are so many people out there who are antagonistic to the idea that industrial civilization as we know it can be brought to an end. And they seem to think that it never can end and that it's a good thing, despite all of the evidence we have to the contrary, that, you know, we're being very much harmed and damaged by the system. So maybe starting with Eric, can we talk about this for a little bit?
Sure. Well, I think it's a very astute analysis, and other people, including our colleague Derek Jensen, have used the analogy of abusive relationships or abusive family to try to understand the dynamics of the culture at large. And I think there's often that that we can use the psychology that shows up in those personal relationships to understand those broader dynamics. I think in general there are a number of reasons that people have so much resistance to the idea of resistance. And I think that the reasons differ depending on, you know, their personal histories and their circumstances. You know, on one level, I think there are a lot of people who genuinely benefit from these power arrangements, at least in material terms, that they may be very wealthy. Even people who are, you know, middle class in the United States are very wealthy in global terms, and benefit from global economic inequality and from unsustainable resource extraction that has its consequences for, you know, other people in other places. So I think that those people are very cooperative sometimes because they feel like they're getting something out of it. And of course, there are people who are, you know, more on the bottom or more marginalized in society. And I think that in any culture of occupation, whether we're talking about civilization in general, whether we're talking about, you know, many systems of slavery, whether we're talking about countries that have been invaded and occupied, one of the things that those occupiers really want to do is both physically and psychologically beat down the people that they're occupying, so that not only do they feel incapable of resisting physically or otherwise, but that it becomes unimaginable. And I think that's really what's happened to many people in the modern day, especially, you know, on the left and especially in the environmental movement, people who should know better, who should realize that, you know, resistance against power is not only possible but necessary, have got it in their head that it's simply impossible to resist. You know, they really can't imagine it in any way, and so they either kind of dismiss it or they become, you know, very afraid at the idea. And I think, you know, there's another reason in addition that I think some people are so afraid of resistance, so afraid that of the idea of the possibility of resistance, and that's because, you know, if resistance is possible, then there are a lot of people who should be fighting back who aren't, and I think that kind of puts a sense of obligation on them. But I think that if we, you know, look at the way that this culture so totally encapsulates our daily lives for most people, that, you know, as Guy Debord called it, the spectacle, that all of our information and our daily experience comes through, you know, rectangular glowing screens that we stare at or that's mediated by the dominant culture, it can become very difficult to access any information from outside of it. And that includes information about, you know, successful resistance movements in the modern day or in the past, which are exactly what we should be learning from and which are kind of the examples that we should be looking at for how people can fight back.
Can I add a little bit?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think that you are right on track, Ron, to be comparing this individual Stockholm syndrome to larger forms of oppression because, you know, indeed, as, you know, different oppressed groups, we also live in very similar kinds of situations where, you know, our lives are at risk and, you know, just like a captive, we can't really see a way out. And there's a really wonderful book that was written by Dee Graham, and the book is called Loving to Survive. And she developed the concept of societal Stockholm syndrome. And this is her thesis, is that we can, you know, take the individual example and broaden it out to the whole culture. And the psychology that's created, you know, in people when they are oppressed and they're living inside a really hostile, violent system, and that it creates the exact kind of dependence on and loyalty to the people, in fact, who are our enemies and who do not mean us well and, in fact, want to keep us enslaved in some way. And it's a really brilliant book, so I would highly recommend it. One of my favorite quotes is actually from Harriet Tubman, who I think is a wonderful person to have as a hero, but this quote is rather poignant. It's not a rousing quote, though she has some of those as well. But and the quote is, "I freed hundreds of slaves, and I could have freed hundreds more if they had but known they were slaves."
Yeah.
And there it is, right there. That's the Stockholm syndrome, you know. And
yeah.
And even in that, you know, level of brutality, people still could not break through, you know, the psychological accommodation, which is necessary to survive. I mean, you have to accommodate if you're going to survive these conditions, but then it makes resistance almost impossible. And that's why, you know, it took, you know, three or four generations for people to get onto the civil rights movement, because they had to, you know, break through that psychology and build back their self-respect and their cultural, you know, the kind of their cultural respect. You had to have the Harlem Renaissance, and then you had to have the Pullman Porters, and finally you get to the civil rights movement. But all that groundwork had to be laid for two or three generations in order for there to be a generation of young people who felt like they could break that identification finally and actually do some, you know, really scary resistance. And they were very brave people, and they were very successful. I mean, I think the civil rights movement really stands still as a, you know, a really a group of wonderful heroes who risked their lives, and some of them lost their lives, but you know, they made some real changes, you know, in this country, and they were really primary changes. So, but it all goes back to that Stockholm syndrome. I think you're absolutely right, Ron, to be bringing that in.
Oh, well, this is very interesting, Lierre. I never heard of that book, Loving to Survive, before, but I'm definitely going to check that out now. And I think that it all comes together with this idea of being held mentally captive to the system. And I think one of the ways that we are held enthralled and fooled into thinking that we need the system is through this idea of progress, through the idea that we are on this trajectory moving ever upward, ever forward, and to some kind of glorious new future. And, you know, we are given this idea of progress as something that's inevitable and something that cannot be halted, especially in the realm of technology. So I was hoping that we could speak for a minute about the cost of this progress and about what it actually means for the natural world and for our own human interactions.
So all it means is that we can more quickly turn living communities into dead commodities. And that's really what civilization is. If you take a living community of trees and rivers and berries and all the animals and plants and whatever, and you turn it into wealth for a few people. And that's what's been happening for 10,000 years. It's the same pattern across civilizations. And then they figured out how to use fossil fuel. So it used to be limited to a lot. You know, it's always based on the military, right? Because you're on drawdown, you're destroying your own land base. So there's all the colonies. You've got to go out and conquer the surrounding countryside around. But you know, that used to be limited by the distance people could walk using pack animals. So Rome could only get so big. You know, the Ming Dynasty can only get so big. Eventually the thing collapses because you can't get military orders and you can't get supplies back and forth. Well, the moment that, you know, the fossil fuel thing came on and the industrial age begins, that totally broke down because suddenly they could go everywhere. And that's why the British Empire was so huge. And that's why now the American Empire is the entire globe. There's nothing to stop it. And what that means is areas of the planet that at least, you know, for a while could stay, you know, in their healthy, wild condition, and there's nothing left. Everything's been taken. 98% of the old growth forests are gone, and 99% of the prairies have been destroyed. In places like China, 80% of the rivers no longer support life. I mean, we could go on, but this is what it means. And, you know, in exchange, what have we got? 5% of the population has a huge pile of plastic crap from China. I mean, it's just, they're not even happy. I mean, half the people in the United States have been on Prozac at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It has created, you know, the loneliest group of people in the world. It's certainly vicious and stupid people. And in the end, it's going to kill the planet. You know, I mean, Eric can talk to the plastic waste dump that's in the ocean and, you know, the amount of plastic that's been created on this planet. Nothing eats plastic. You know, it's a brand new substance. And in the past, you know, everything that was ever born and grew and lived, there was somebody ready to eat you when you were done with your body. Plastic, there's nobody to eat it. And so we are literally drowning in plastic at this point, which is a very toxic substance. So we may end up being, you know, the people that killed themselves with their own waste products. Yeah, it's a little grim. So I'll pass it on to Eric.
Mm-hmm. I think Lierre is exactly right. And I think that the biotic indicators that she talked about make it really clear what the consequences of this progress have become. I think that progress is a myth, is a really effective way of controlling people. And it's one of the most important myths in our society, in industrial society. And I think that if you accept that myth is true, just as if you, you know, accept industrial capitalism as a given, then it really neutralizes your ability to make up any kind of effective critique or to undertake effective action. So, you know, under this idea of progress, everything that's been happening over the past several hundred years has been good, and everything that's been good has been a result of, you know, the spread of democracy through, you know, the same kind of Western parliamentary representative systems that we see, whether it comes from, you know, oil or resource exploitation or new technology. And of course, if you take progress as a given, then you're not really allowed to question any of those systems, and it becomes very difficult to criticize the destruction that they've created.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we say, well, maybe we should be learning from traditional cultures who have lived sustainably on their land for, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, then all of a sudden the answer is, oh, well, you know, we can't do that because that's going back and we have to, you know, keep having progress. And it's the same if you ever suggest giving up any kind of technology. So, you know, you say, oh, well, we can't stop using fossil fuels because we have to move forward, not backward. And this idea that, you know, is kind of commonly put forward by people who quote Buckminster Fuller, that you don't try to disrupt a paradigm, you come up with a new paradigm that's better, and then through progress, everyone will accept it. But of course, that's not really how things work. The dominant system, the dominant culture is in place because it benefits a small number of people at the top of the pyramid, and because they can, you know, profit immensely by destroying the world. So so that suggestion that is not going to allow them to do that, to profit while destroying the world, is going to be considered a step backward. And any solution that allows them to keep doing that is not a solution at all. You know, most traditional sustainable cultures have this idea of history occurring in cycles, that time is cyclical and things keep happening over again and again and again. And I think that the dominant culture has a much different narrative. You know, history has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if this culture continues, it will definitely have an end, not just of industrial civilization, but of a livable biosphere.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if I can just bring in a pop culture reference to this conversation, even though maybe it's a little bit spectacle oriented, but I'm sure you both are familiar with Star Trek, right? So, yeah, there's this idea that, you know, we're going to continue moving forward and our technology is going to grow and somehow we're going to come up with all of these amazing new devices or energy sources that will catapult us into the stars or whatever. And people think that, yeah, the future in 1,000 years or 500 years will look, you know, similar to Star Trek. But to me, a disturbing warning given from Star Trek is this this culture called the Borg. And if you're familiar with this, you know, the Borg are these beings that basically are like cybernetic. So they're half human or half humanoid and half machine. And they kind of live in sort of like an internet world, like kind of how we're going into now, where everyone is kind of plugged in, except that for them it's like a physical virtual reality. And yet they go from planet to planet, extracting resources and basically killing people and absorbing them into their own collective. And when people resist, they destroy them. And when what disturbs me is that I think we're moving more towards that than more towards this kind of, you know, Star Trek future where people think we're going to be walking around in these kind of, you know, snappy, sexy uniforms and, you know, beautiful machines and everything and technology. And it's really worrying to me the direction that our society is heading in. And I don't know if you two want to speak a little bit about that, but that's just a thought I just randomly had when we were talking about this idea of progress.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Borg are really a perfect analogy for the dominant culture, and I think they're much more spot on than the people who, you know, actually wrote Star Trek probably realized. Derek Jensen and I take on this idea of a technotopia a lot in our book, What We Leave Behind. And I think that, you know, there are many different reasons why people find this kind of technotopian solution plausible. Certainly they find it appealing because it's very convincing. It means we don't really have to change anything, just keep doing what we're doing and things will more or less work themselves out. I think one of the big reasons that people believe in the ability of technology to, you know, make us kind of expand to other worlds or have all of these supernatural abilities is because they don't understand carrying capacity. You know, carrying capacity is the ability of land to support a population indefinitely. And in his book, Overshoot, the Revolutionary Basis of Ecological, or the Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change, rather, William Catton Jr. writes that there are only two ways to increase carrying capacity. There's takeover and drawdown. So, you know, if I live on an island and there are only so many people we can support by, you know, growing food on this particular island, then one way is takeover, that we can go invade the next island over and, you know, take their food or make them grow stuff for us or, you know, kill them all and colonize their land. And of course, this is one of the fundamental strategies that's been used by civilization and by all kinds of cultures of occupation to expand. It's something that we see, you know, through the, especially over the last 500 years with Western civilization. And then the other strategy is drawdown, that you use up finite resources faster than you can. So if we're growing food on our island, then we, you know, have industrial wells and we suck up all the groundwater, or we till the soil and we erode it and use up all the soil, or, you know, we eat all of the wild animals faster than they can reproduce and this sort of thing. And really, technology that we've developed, industrial technology, has pretty much just allowed us to accelerate those two basic methods of increasing carrying capacity, or temporarily, you know, the drawdown is a temporary kind of phantom way of increasing carrying capacity. And people don't understand that. You know, they think that we've actually made some kind of permanent increase in the ability of our planet to support life through technology, but that's not the way it's worked. Industrial technology really does the opposite. And in terms of takeover, we're really at a dead end. You know, the planet is full at this point. There's corn and wheat and soybeans growing pretty much everywhere that they can be grown. Every single, you know, drawdownable resource is at the brink. I mean, we've passed, we've used more than half of the oil. The water is being drawn down at horrendous rates all over the planet. So it's really a dead end. And if people don't get out of this kind of technotopian illusion, then it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah, Lier, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think underlying the basis of this culture is a real death urge, because I just can't fathom why anybody would want to leave this planet. This is the most amazing place to be.
Right, and this idea
that people would rather live among shiny machines somewhere on some dark, you know, corner of the universe where there's no sunshine and no, I can't understand why that would be an appealing vision. And yet so many people seem drawn to it. That's not the thing that I enjoy about science fiction at all. What I loved about science, I read a lot when I was a teenager, and I just loved, you know, the way that people could create whole new societies. And a lot of them, you know, were very pointed political statements about what was wrong with this world. And that I really enjoyed. But this idea that we would somehow, you know, leave the planet, why would anybody want to leave this beautiful place? It is such an incredible gift to have been born here. And I just can't figure out why. Why does everybody hate the Earth so much?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I never thought about it that way, but the way the dominant culture is forcing us to think about it is that the Earth is something that we should want to leave, or it's kind of just a temporary holding space for us to launch ourselves into the universe. And I really personally can't prove this, but I do believe that there are ways to travel without having to leave the planet. And I think that other cultures knew about these things. And maybe we have lost some of that knowledge, but I really feel that I agree so much with that. I think that we don't know if life exists on anywhere else besides this planet for sure. I mean, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But I think we're taking it for granted what we have here, because we think, oh yeah, the universe is so big and there has to be other planets. And if we mess things up on this planet, then, you know, we'll just go somewhere else and find another one. And I think that's part of the That's where some of this resistance comes from to dismantling industrial civilization, is that people think that, oh, you know, well, if we there's another place out there somewhere, and there might not be, and that's the kind of scary thing. So I think we do need to start gradually bringing this thing to an end and some type of way. And I was wondering, can I ask you both, is the end of industrial civilization something that can happen gradually? Is there a way for this thing to end this, allowing people a chance to maybe adapt to the changes? I mean, what do you guys think about that?
Well, you know, physically, there's no laws of physics that say we can't do it that way. And that would be the same thing to do. You know, if all the institutions that kind of rule the societies around the globe could just get together, face up to the fact that we are on massive overshoot, that the fossil fuel will run out someday, that we're out of soil, we're out of species, we're out of water, we've used it all, we've trashed the planet. We could pull back from the brink. It actually is not that hard to figure out what to do next. We could even stop global warming. My problem is I don't see any evidence that people are going to do what's rational or sane or just. In fact, I think that the powerful are probably just going to cling harder as things get scarier. And that, to me, says it's up to us to really take control of this. you know, that it's up to the people, because the wealthy are not going to do it for us. They've got way too much at stake in terms of, you know, they're all about increasing their wealth, however psychopathological that is. That's what they're geared for. And what that means is the rest of us are going to starve more than we are now. I mean, we know the statistics on world hunger. They're pretty grim, and it just means that's going to increase. And it's also that the rich can have more. I mean, that's really what it's about. So they have our wealth, and we need to take it back. So having said that, yes, I think that it's very possible that we could do this in a way that, you know, respects civic order, that respects justice, that increases justice, and that returns us to a sustainable way of life. But I don't have a lot of faith that the institutions that are now in charge are going to do that.
Right. Now, Eric, before you add something to this, I want to say that there has been a lot of criticism of people who advocate ending industrial civilization because they say, well, what about the people who are receiving cancer treatments, and what about the people who need wheelchairs or who need glasses or who need HIV medications or who need diabetes treatments? What will happen to these people if industrial civilization ends? And this is a common thing that we hear all the time, so I was wondering what your response is to that.
Well, you're talking about me. I have a degenerative disease as well as an autoimmune disease. This is not something that I say lightly, but my life is not that important. We are all going to die, and I am not going to kill the planet just so I can live. Mm-hmm. I mean, my life is not worth that. It's not worth a river. It's not worth the whole species. It certainly isn't worth the whole planet. That at a certain point, we have to accept that death is inevitable for all of us. Having said that, my life's going to be a lot harder if I don't have access to the medications I need. I accept that. You know, this is not about me personally. I am not that precious. Not a single one of us is that precious. And I will also say that, you know, the diseases that we have just named are all diseases of civilization. The hunter-gatherers do not get those kind of chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases. Those populations are free of that. And it's agriculture that creates that, okay, because it doesn't meet the needs of the human template. And it's not until agriculture develops that you see in the archaeological record people having those chronic diseases. So, you know, it's a problem we've created for ourselves. And, yes, there will be suffering. There's no way around it. I am one of the people who's going to suffer, probably one of the ones to die early on, and that's the way it goes. We need a living planet. Without a living planet, we are all dead. And the point is to, you know, save something, enough of a biome that, you know, life can regenerate, and then hopefully learn to live as humble participants once more instead of as these sort of dominating monsters that, you know, we've been turned into.
Eric, do you want to add something to that?
Just that I think that if we actually sat down and did the math and said, you know, how many people are cured of cancer in this culture and how many people are given culture, not just in industrialized world where fancy technological culture or cancer treatments are available, but all over the world, I think it would be pretty clear that in terms of, you know, cancer and many different ailments and injuries, that civilization is a, you know, the net cause, not a net cure.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for instance, you know, they're on wind power, also to be on board with wind power. It's just creating massive amounts of cancer in China because it's mining for those minerals that create the magnets for the windmills. It's an immensely toxic process. And so adults and children both now, they're living in this like, toxic swamp where those mines are, and they're getting pancreatic cancer, kidney cancer, all, you know, horrible deep organ cancers that they all die from. And, you know, we're all supposed to get behind this like it's somehow clean and green, and it's just as hideous as the other extractive technologies that this culture produces.
Yeah, I saw that article. I think it was on the Daily Mail. And I remember the first time I went to Germany, I saw these huge wind, whatever they are. And I was like, wow, these are so amazing, and this is just awesome how we can have this clean technology. But then, learning some years later about actually what goes into making these things – and it's always exported somewhere else far, far away.
Right.
Where, you know, that's kind of the scary part about it. If industrial civilization isn't brought to an end gradually, then, of course, the other option is that it's going to come to an abrupt end at some point where things are just no longer sustainable. So I was wondering if we could talk about what is going to happen if we don't have this soft landing, if industrial civilization does come to an abrupt end.
Well, people are talking now about the climate holocaust, that this planet will be so hot in somewhere from 50 to 100 years that there may not even be bacteria left. So at that point, you've just got a bare rock turning through space, and that may well be the end point. And I think this is why we need to feel the emergency, because I don't want that to happen to every living creature. I would like this planet to continue until the sun is gone. You know, we've got a few more billion years here if we would just take care of what we've got. And so, it is grim, and I think that, you know, the road to that end would be horrible for both humans and non-humans alike in every conceivable way. So I don't know why more people aren't feeling this emergency.
And I think that, you know, we were talking earlier about this kind of technotopian myth or the idea that, that we'll develop some kind of new green industrial future. And there are, of course, a lot of people who criticize that and who are aware that it's a falsehood, especially people who are well-informed about peak oil and energy issues. But, you know, I also think that, that there are a lot of people who think that peak oil will kind of solve our problems for us and that, you know, declining oil availability will head off global warming and then there will kind of be this gradual decline and everything will be okay. But I'm not actually very optimistic about that. We can have a collapse of society, of civilization, and still have, you know, horrific runaway global warming. But if we, you know, if we stop this culture, then we can stop global warming. But we can't have this culture kind of continue on, even if it's just, you know, limping along on decreasing fuel supplies. That's still enough to destroy the planet if we don't act.
Right. Now, we've been speaking a lot about the effects that all of this will have on human culture and human society and ourselves personally. But can we talk a little bit about what's actually happening right now to the non-human world? And this is something that we don't really hear about too much. I mean, we do know something about the species that are disappearing. And if you go to a zoo or something, you can kind of read little blurbs about things that are happening. And maybe on the news occasionally you'll hear something about a rainforest being chopped down. But in general, I think we're very shielded from the really grim effects that our culture is having on the world right now. So can we talk a little bit about the carnage that is really being wreaked upon the natural world at this very moment?
Well, I can tell you that there are provinces in China right now where there are no longer any flowering plants. And that's because all the pollinators are dead. So there's no bees. The insects are gone. The creatures that would be pollinating those plants they're all dead. So having wiped them out, now the plants are gone. And so for the people to have anything like an apple or a head of lettuce, they have to hand pollinate all their crops. So to have wiped out all of the pollinating, all the plants that need pollination, that is literally 500 million years of evolution that was just in a blink of an eye was gone because of human carelessness and human greed. And or whatever else you want to call it, human sociopathology, I don't even know what to call it at this point, insanity.
Mm-hmm.
So 500 million years of evolution has been wiped out, and that is the future we are all looking at. I mean, we can go through species by species, but every day there are 200 species going extinct, and this is a mass extinction event. It's like nothing the world has ever seen before.
Now, people think this is hyperbole, but is this a real fact that every single day 200 species are disappearing? This is a fact, right?
Yeah. That's absolutely. I mean, I used to use 120, and then I used 150, and then, you know, you can research around, and it's 200. I mean, that is the accurate figure right now.
Well, every single day. So, Eric, do you want to add something to this?
Sure. I just said, you know, we can look at any big picture biomes. I mean, we can look at entire biomes like the ocean. You know, the stat from a few years ago is that 90% of the big fish in the ocean are gone. Now the latest is up to 95 from some studies. Most of the tropical forests are gone, and the boreal forests are really starting to suffer under, you know, climate change as well as industrial logging and many other things. And then we're already seeing the start of different tipping points in global warming, geysers of methane coming out of the Arctic seafloor, you know, prolonged droughts in the Amazon. And at the same time, you know, in 2009, after the economic downturn, the global economic downturn, that was actually one of the best years, one of the best ecological years in recent history for the Amazon rainforest. It was the year with the lowest deforestation since records have been kept. Electricity use was down for the first time since World War II. Landfill use was down in the States somewhere like 30%. And so I think there's kind of, you know, we can look at the statistics and it's incredibly clear what the relationship is between capitalism and the destruction of the planet. It's just so direct.
Yes, very sobering thought. But I think it's also hopeful that if we can end industrial capitalism, maybe we can slow this down a lot because, like you just said, when there's a downturn in the system, it gives ecosystems a chance to kind of, you know, recuperate. So hopefully something like that will happen very soon.
Exactly. If there's just a little blip and it can do that much good, you know, if people are actually saying, well, maybe we should target the industrial economy as a strategy, then we can get a lot more accomplished.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. So moving on, I don't want to I have a lot more ground to cover, and I don't want to make sure we don't go over time. There was recently a critique written of Lierre's book, The Vegetarian Myth. And this was written on NEFEC and the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communist website. And I want to bring this up because I think it brings up a lot of interesting points and criticisms of anti-civ philosophy or, you know, thinkings. And it's not just talking about the vegetarian aspect. It's talking also about agriculture and die-off and things like that. So that I think it covers a lot of territory. So that's why I want to kind of get both of your opinions on this, even though it was directed more towards Lierre. So my first question about this article is how does agriculture, as we know it, contribute to systems of domination? Now, we know that getting rid of capitalism and replacing it with a more egalitarian system while still keeping some semblance of modern day agriculture seems to be the author's favorite solution. I mean, the author of this article. But is this something that is actually feasible, in your opinion, Lierre, starting with you?
No. Agricultural societies always end up militarized. And the reason they do is because they're based on drawdown. So the author of that article does not understand the nature of agriculture. Agriculture is biotic cleansing. Okay, you take a piece of land, in very brute terms, you clear every living thing off it. And I mean down to the bacteria. So the plants, the animals, everything that's supposed to live there to build that soil is cleared. It has to be in order to plant what you're going to plant. And that means that you've killed it all. You've destroyed it. And so every year that goes by, you're not building soil, you're drawing down the soil. You're using it up like a resource. And at the end of 100 years or 200 years or 1,000 years, however long it takes, the soil is gone. And it also means you're using up the trees as you go and you're using up the water. And this is why these societies end up militarized, is that they then have to go and get their basic resources from somewhere else. Okay, and this is why it is never going to produce justice as a material basis for a society, because it's based on drawdown. There is no way to do this sustainably. And so, you know, throughout history for the last 10,000 years, that's the pattern. You have this bloated power center in the middle, and then you have around it the conquered colonies, and there are always colonies for that reason, because it's a system of human sustenance that's based on drawdown. So, no, this can't be done sustainably, and there is no way to make it just.
Eric, your thoughts on agriculture?
I have the same perspective as Lierre, so I'll just let her cover that one.
Okay, cool. So now I'll move on to this quote from the article here. It says that killing off, or the need to kill off, 5 billion people is not an answer to anything. We need to find ways to exist sustainably with each other and the non-human world, something I think is possible, without killing off billions of humans and forcing people to eat meat. So the author is claiming that if agriculture as we know it is dismantled, we need to, quote, kill off about 5 billion people. And as you just heard, she reiterates the points several times just to make sure we understand that 5 billion people will have to be killed. And this is something that we've been or I've been kind of hearing a lot recently in critiques of those who want to bring down industrial civilization. Now, what is really going on here? Like, it seems that she, the author, is, I'm not sure if she's genuinely afraid of this or if she's using a kind of rhetorical tactic. I mean, what do you think is going on here?
I don't actually know what's going on. I find it somewhere between offensive and absurd that anybody would claim that I am saying we should kill 5 billion people. I mean, it's such an absurd thing to even say out loud. It makes me want to laugh. But nowhere across the entire 46 years of my life have I said we should kill 5 billion people. I mean, it's just, I can't even argue against it. It's so ridiculous. Of course I'm not calling for that. Nobody is. My point is that we're all going to die. And if we can simply reproduce at less than replacement levels, this problem will take care of itself. And we know how to drop the population. It's actually not hard. You do two things. You raise the standard of living, and you raise the status of women. Now, the reason that people are poor is because the rich are stealing from them. So we need to end capitalism. And the reason that women don't control their own bodies is because of a system of power called patriarchy, which is male domination. So we're all to be feminists as well. If we can do those two things, the population drops naturally. And so, in other words, if we should be doing those things anyway because justice, right? It means dismantling those hierarchies that are creating so much suffering around the world. If we dismantle them, that is, in fact, the way to save the planet. So from every angle, this is the right thing to do. So I don't understand where this killing 5 billion people comes from. It's nothing that I have ever argued for, and frankly, I've never heard anybody argue for it. So it's some kind of straw man, but I don't know why she wants to create this mess.
Eric, any thoughts on this?
Sure. Well, I think that, as Lierre has said, the responsible way to address the issue of drawdown, of destroying, you know, the planet through agriculture, is to shift away from agriculture and to allow people to have the power to control their reproduction, allow women to have the power to control their reproduction so that the population starts to decrease. And it's really the status quo, continuing to increase the population because women can't control their own bodies and continuing to destroy the basis of, supporting life on this planet. It's that trajectory that's going to lead to mass deaths. And so, you know, if you refuse to acknowledge that or refuse to do anything about it, well, that's what's actually going to kill people.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And I want to add, too, that there's already 33 countries that have negative population growth. So, in fact, we do know how to do this. And some of these countries have gone about it very systematically. And I'm not talking about the horrors of China. I mean places like Iran, where they realized they were on dramatic overshoot, that, you know, in another generation there wasn't going to be anywhere to stand, let alone anything to eat or drink. And, you know, they put in place a series of public policies that over a very short period of time, like 5 years, they were able to drop very dramatic rates of population growth to just below replacement levels. And they did this essentially by empowering women and making birth control available everywhere. And it, you know, it worked really, really well. And like I said, these are things we need to be doing anyway. But, you know, if we could, you know, institute those around the world, institute those kinds of policies and give women that kind of help, and then while we were at it, we could be slowly repairing the earth from the ravages of agriculture. You know, in 100 years, this could be a completely different planet. And it's not that hard to see from A to B. So we really don't need to be making up the stuff about murdering 5 billion people overnight. Nobody's talking about that.
Yeah, I personally have never heard anyone speak about that. A friend of mine mentioned something that John Zerzan had said years ago about the Unabomber, some statement he made that could have been construed as sympathetic. And I think from that, people extrapolate outwards to 5 billion people dying. I'm not really sure exactly how they get from here to there, but it seems to be a common argument I'm running up against a lot these days. And I think a lot of it comes from partially this irrational fear of death. And I'm glad that you spoke about this earlier, your own struggle and your own kind of personal reconcilement with your own mortality. And I think this is something that we're not taught to acknowledge in our culture. We're taught to just enjoy life and carry on as if our life will never end, and then at some point in the future, in some nebulous, foggy future, we know we're going to die, but we're never really taught to think about death and to deal with it. And even the way that death is like an industry, and the way that people are usually not surrounded by family and friends at the time of the death, like people used to be in more traditional cultures, I think this is where these kind of frantic, irrational ideas come from, because people are just – they just have no way to conceptualize the idea of people dying except as some kind of horrible, terrible thing, instead of just a natural process of you live, you die. Plants live, plants die. Bugs live, bugs die. You know, everything lives, everything dies. And this is not really something that we're taught to accept or even acknowledge. So – yeah, I kind of went off on a little soapbox there, but the author of this article seems to think that we can end domination, control, and coercion and still keep industrial civilization as in some form. Now, do you guys think that this is something that's possible?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
I don't think so.
Eric, you go first. You go first, Eric.
Thank you. You can look at anything that industrial civilization is based on. I mean, look at petroleum. Look at where that is actually coming from. And tell me that you can get it without a system based on domination, control, and coercion. Or look at the tar sands and what's happening to people who live in that area. And if you want to talk about some, you know, brave technotopian future where we don't use oil, then let's talk about the things that you would need. I mean, let's talk about rare earth metals or coltan. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, over the last decade or so, close to 2 million women have been raped as part of, you know, terrorism that's going on in a war to loot the minerals in that country, including the kind of minerals that are, you know, required for manufacturing basic electronic technology, cell phones and computers and all of that. Or we can look at steel. You know, there's still slavery going on in Brazil to manufacture charcoal that supports the steel industry there. The trouble is not finding an example of a resource that requires domination, control, and coercion. The problem is that it's almost impossible to find one that doesn't.
Right.
It all rests on the same platform of extraction. So, you know, in order to get things like oil, you know, you have to rip the land apart. And that means you have to rip the people off their land. And that means you have to rip those people in half. And so this is why you have, you know, military juntas all over the world and private military forces. I mean, oil companies have their own private militaries. I don't know if people in America understand that. They have their own private militaries. And this is why. It's because they have to rip people in half to get to the resources. And then they destroy it. That's what's happened to the Niger Delta, which is an example that we talk about a lot, Eric and I and Derek, because it's so grim. I mean, it's, you know, they've taken the largest wetland in the world and turned it into a sludge land, and the people there used to be completely self-sufficient, and now they're all sick and starving. And there's been incredible resistance there from the indigenous people, and some of it very successful. They, you know, the group MEND, which is the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, they're just a few hundred of them, and they are very well trained, and they know doing, and they've gone after the oil industry and gone after it and after it, and their best quote is, you know, leave our land while you can or die in it, and they mean it. They've reduced the oil output of Nigeria by 30%. In fact, there was a series of attacks last December where they stopped 80% of the country's oil production in one, about 5 days of attacks, 80%. So this can be done. And, you know, these are people who are defending their land and they're defending their community because that's what it takes, you know, to produce oil is you're going to kill everything around it, including the people and, you know, the human people, the non-human people. So I just can't fathom why anybody would say that this can be done in a way that doesn't have domination and coercion. That's all it is domination and coercion.
Right. I think for us is that we don't see this domination happening right in front of our faces. So for us, it's kind of sanitized, really. And I think the Niger Delta is a really great example because the people there really did try. I mean, they tried everything they could before they resorted to quote-unquote violence or whatever. But when they realized...
They tried nonviolence, yes, they did.
Yeah, so I think that's the point that we have to get to ourselves here, realizing that writing letters and talking to Congress people and, you know, it's not working anymore. And it's fine to try it, but it's not enough. And you know, like we've been talking about, things are getting worse and worse, and we don't really have time to keep dealing with these nonsensical arguments, and you know, this is really holding us back from doing what we need to do. So this next question is more for Lierre, but Eric, if you want to jump in and add something, that would be great too. So the author of the article I've been talking about claims that, quote, moral vegetarians, political vegetarians, and nutritional vegetarians were proven wrong by the vegetarian myth. So, Lierre, was this your intent to simply prove people wrong? And if not, what was your intent in writing your book? And also, could you speak for a moment about your own personal experience with veganism and why you decided to change course and write the book the way you did?
My intent was not really to prove anybody wrong. It was really just to be helpful. That there's really a whole generation of us that grew up kind of on the left and whatever version of left. And this kind of idea about the plant-based diet has really taken hold, that, you know, you're going to save the planet and you're going to save animals and you're going to feed hungry people, and these are all these really great reasons to do it. Oh, and by the way, it's really good for your health. So I believed all of that for 20 years. I was a vegan for 20 years, and I destroyed my body permanently. And then when I had to kind of re-examine all those questions, all the reasons I had done it, it, you know, it turned out that none of that information was actually true. Or some of the facts were correct, but if you went the next layer deep, in fact, it was so, they were so not true that it ended up being just a complete myth. So, you know, for instance, this idea that, you know, you're going to save animals by doing this. Well, this is not in any way choose factory farming. I think we can all agree that that is just, you know, hell on earth. It needs to stop. But, you know, you look at your plate and you think, well, there's nothing dead on this plate. It's all rice and beans and whatnot. The problem is you have to go to the next level and say, well, it's not just about what's dead on your plate. It's what died to get that food on your plate. And if you're eating agricultural foods, what's died is entire continents. And that was the part I didn't understand. I mean, I had no basis to understand that. Nobody had told me that. I had no critique of agriculture. I didn't even know what it was, really. I just knew it didn't involve dead animals, therefore it must be good. So I wanted to take a step back and ask everybody on the left to reexamine these ideas from the perspective of the entire planet. And, you know, what is, in fact, creating world hunger? Well, it's not the, it's a power imbalance. It's got nothing to do with the fact that, you know, people and farmers in Kansas are having to overproduce corn. I mean, that is driven by the fact that we live in a, you know, this corporate hierarchy, and there's six nations that control the world food supply, and they're able to command a monopoly, and therefore, you know, farmers all over the world are essentially searched to them. So they have to overproduce corn. And that's where that surplus comes from. But there's no way that that's, you know, a sustainable way for starving people to live. Because those people are hungry because their land's been taken away and their livelihoods have been stolen by those six same corporations. And that's what has to be dismantled. You're not going to feed hungry people by sending them, you know, food from the United States. You're going to feed hungry people by getting the United States, the boot of the United States off their neck so that they can go back to producing their own food. So we've had this completely backwards. So I really wanted people on the left to reexamine these ideas because, well, number one, we look like idiots, but number two, you know, we're completely on the wrong track, that the planet needs to be repaired, and more of the same is not going to save us. So my call is really to repair the prairies and the forests and the wetlands and learn to participate again as members of those communities and take our food from within those living communities rather than imposing ourselves across them with the biotic cleansing of agriculture. And I know this means, you know, reversing this process, but I don't actually think it would be that hard. Life wants to live. You know, if you've ever tried gardening or farming, you know how much work it is. And the reason it's that much work is because you're fighting nature every step of the way. Well, why fight it? Let's just, you know, accept it and go back to being, you know, humble participants once more. We would have much better lives. We would live longer and we would have a planet to live on. So in the end, it didn't seem that hard, but, it's, people have to wrap their minds around this. It's the, not the knowledge that we've been given, you know, on the, it's not what's the acceptable practice on the left right now. So my real goal was to get people to reexamine this because our planet is at stake and we are going to have to question what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years if we've got any hope of repairing this damage before it's too late. So that was really the reason.
Yeah, I can really see the wisdom in that because over the past 30 years, I think veganism and vegetarianism has really become almost like a fad in a culture and a lifestyle, and yet it's really been doing nothing to, you know, stop the destruction that's been happening, unfortunately, even though some, I mean, I can't judge anyone for choosing that lifestyle or that way of living, but I do think that it is something that should be questioned, and I think that people who are not, you know, strict vegans or whatever are sometimes in the left or in activist circles kind of looked down upon or judged because they're saying, oh, how can you support, you know, factory farming. And this is why, Eric, I wanted to bring you into this also, because I remember hearing you speaking on another radio show about your own experiences. I think you have some kind of local co-op or something you're working with, free-range food and things like that. I was wondering if you can speak about that in connection with how there's a difference between factory farming and the type of farming that you can do that is more humane and more sustainable.
Sure, I can talk quickly about that. I live on a farm in Ontario, Canada. We have a few different things going on. There's an organic dairy herd that my partner's parents take care of, and they're just out on grass. I can look out the window and see them right now. And then we have, you know, chickens and ducks who are also on pasture, and we have, you know, a vegetable garden that feeds about 150 families through what's called community shared agriculture. And what we try to do as much as possible is something that Leah writes about in her book, which is called perennial polycultures. So rather than basing the system on, you know, annual grains where every year we have to, you know, till up the entire farm and plant new grains and that destroys all of the soil, we try wherever possible to maintain, you know, that normal mixture of different plants and of forest as well on the farm that keeps the soil covered and that actually builds the soil, especially when you have ruminants out there. And so, you know, that's certainly something that we've seen as we've kind of improved our techniques and improved that perennial polyculture cover, is that the soil gets healthier and that the animals are healthier as well.
Awesome, awesome. So coming to our final two questions here, I want to ask you both about the upcoming book I think was just released or is about to be released called Deep Green Resistance. And I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that and what readers can expect from this work that you did with Derek Jensen?
Well, part of the problem is that none of the solutions that we're being, you know, told to take up, none of them actually match the scale of the problem. So they're not actually solutions. And, you know, what's at stake is pretty much everything. So we wanted to present some goals that we think are the goals we should be aiming for, and that's, you know, essentially to stop the ability of the rich to steal from the poor and the powerful to destroy the planet, and then to repair our planet, including the human communities that, you know, need to live here too. So that's our, you know, sort of our grand goal. And then from there, you know, how would we get from A to B? So we've developed a strategy, and we wanted to let people know about it because I don't see anything else like this out there. So we basically saw a hole in the discourse and tried to figure out how we could bridge the gap. So we are suggesting certain strategies that we think would be effective. And then there's a lot of information about past movements and what they've done and how they've been successful or not, and some basic information on explicating more of, you know, what exactly is the problem. So, you know, all these different interlocking hierarchies that are based on domination, the fact that we are on such tremendous drawdown, and how there are no technological solutions. And so all of that is laid out really clearly as well. So it's kind of like, you know, a big guidebook to, you know, what we could do over the next 50 years and why, how it would work and why we think people should take this up.
Oh, cool. Eric, anything you want to add to that?
Just that I think that on the left in general, there are a lot of perceptions about how social change and political change work that are not really based in, you know, historical examples. There's really a lot of faith in persuasion, for example, that social change works when those in power are persuaded to change through rational argument, and that's not really how it works. It works when people develop political force, and that's what makes social change. And so one of the things that we really try to do is look at examples of groups that have, you know, done that and that have succeeded, and how we can learn from their example.
Okay, great. Now, my final question is about the Deep Green Resistance workshops, and hopefully I'll be able to attend one of these in the near future. I think there's one in Colorado I'm going to try to get to. I think that this is a really great idea, and both of you do these workshops, I think, over a period of 2 or 3 days with Derek Jensen. And I was wondering if you can talk about this, like the format of this and how it works and what people could expect if they decide that they want to participate in one of these.
It's
sure,
sort of a crash course in how to be a resistance movement, because we have not been trained to think strategically or even to think tactically on the left. And we've sort of abandoned all concept that we might actually be effective. So we're trying to reinsert some of these concepts back into the movement. So, you know, what does strategy look like? How is it effective? So we really put people through their paces in terms of learning to think strategically. And we also have a lot of fun, but that's not really the point. I mean, the point is that we're trying to look very seriously at the situation and then what would actually be an effective response. So we have various ways of coming at this problem to get, people have a lot of emotional reluctance. You know, they're very attached to what they've been doing, even though it has not worked. Mm. So we try to get them to think, you know, bigger. You know, like we have biological indicators and people suggest various strategies, and then, you know, at the end of the day, did it work? You know, did you actually help species increase? Did you help the health of the oceans? Did you help reforestation? And, you know, almost nothing that anybody comes up with actually improves the biological indicators. So they're sort of forced to face that it's not working. And it's a hard moment for people, but it has to be done because we're out of time.
Right, right.
So our next conference, as you mentioned, is in Colorado at the end of this May. And then if you want to know more, or if you want to kind of get a sneak preview of the book before it's available in the next few weeks, you can also visit deepgreenresistance.org.